Hello and welcome to the Screaming Cinema Podcast. We are back again on a regular basis, and I think we've all been waiting since early last week to get on this pod and talk about the Batman. I'm also going to be jumping into a quick review on Fresh, which hit Hulu on Friday. New horror thriller movie to discuss, one that Preston talked about in our last episode. So I'm going to kick things off, do some intros here, joined by Preston Barta. What's up, man?
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How many times have you seen the Batman?
I've seen it three times, and I definitely plan to go more.
All right, awesome. And also have James Cole Clay in the house, getting his lawn done, so maybe on mute here. How many times have you seen it? Two? Don't know. Okay.
No,
yeah, like
twice. Twice. Twice.
Oh, good. There you go. Yeah. Sorry. I think I had a connection jump there. But yeah, if you guys want to have anything you want to touch on before we hit on Fresh that you've watched or been dying to talk about here.
Cool, you can go first.
Not really. I mean, in terms of horror stuff, it's really just been Fresh and I guess technically Batman. I guess if you want to call that horror, but no, that's not true. I did watch something very horrifying, and that was Memoirs of an Invisible Man, but we don't have to talk about that.
I bought it and I'm haven't watched it yet, but I'm going to. I'm working my way through my blind spots on the Carpenter filmography.
That's what I was doing. That's exactly what I was doing.
That's awesome.
Yeah, movie's terrible.
It sucks.
Really? Well, now I own it, so that's good.
Carpenter completionist, though.
Yeah, I am. Absolutely.
Exactly. He's my guy.
All right. Well, Preston, what about you?
I don't know if this really qualifies as horror, but there are some horrifying elements to it, which I guess is the position we're taking with the Batman anyway. I watched Drop Dead Fred last week, and I should be having a full review of that on High Def Digest pretty soon, maybe tomorrow. Vinegar Syndrome put this out.
Yep.
Really great disc. I grew up with that movie. This is my kid copy on VHS, which is still in really great condition. That was just a movie that was very important to me. And as soon as, so it was like last year, Vinegar Syndrome announced that they were putting it out, and then something happened. I don't know if it was like some licensing issue or what, but I like pre-ordered it. And then we got these emails saying that, hey, it's not going to work out, sorry. And then a couple of months ago, they said, hey, it's back on, we got it all figured out. And so it's actually out there for you to purchase on through Vinegar Syndrome. It looks really good. If you don't know what the movie's about, it's kind of like tonally like Little Monsters, where it's like this wacky manic dude who's like an invisible friend to our central character played by Phoebe Cates. And it's kind of like this, like if Bing Bong from Inside Out was just this really crazy Beetlejuice kind of person who just is the source of why we're so mischievous as children. The reasons why we do things and we don't listen to our parents and we lash out, we unspool all the toilet paper and put it in the toilet, and just everything that drives our parents up the wall. But on the other hand, so as a kid, I related to that mischievous part of it, and just like wanting to do very senseless things and wanting to always, because we're part of this Peter Pan generation, or at least I am, that doesn't want to grow up and just always wants to be a kid. And so watching this as an adult now is entirely different, especially from a parent perspective, because there's a mother in here that just does not want her child to grow up and and doesn't like the idea of her kind of being her own person, and blames her for every reason why her marriage failed and things like that. So there's some really dark stuff in it. And so tonally, it's just such a really interesting movie. But I could go on and on about that movie, but there's some good extras on there, some good interviews. Some of them were taken from like 2016 or so, but they're still interesting nonetheless. There's some good stuff on it. So that's a drop tip for it.
I got, I think I told you I had the 6 month vinegar syndrome subscription last year. I decided not to do it. So you get some good value, but I don't want half of those movies. So I bought a couple this last month. I got Dead Heat. I got Madman in 4K, and then I got Forgotten Gialli Volume 4, because I think I have 2 and 3 as well. So I haven't watched any of them yet, but my list of stuff to watch is kind of ridiculously long at this point.
This is really random. I have two things to say about things that you guys both said. One, I feel like Drop Dead Fred must still live in me, because I'm very mature, and like I handle all my responsibilities. Anybody who listens out there, like, but God, I am the biggest shithead ever. and I love it, and it's great. And it's so much fun. I love being like really youthful and silly and like mischievous and like sneaking up on my girlfriend throughout the house. Maybe that's every guy, I don't know. But and then the second thing is, Max, if you're really into Giallo, you really need to check out two movies. They're not Giallo movies, but they're more inspired from the past 10 years. That's The Editor and Barbarian Sound Studio. Have you seen either one of those films?
Nope. Barbarian Sound Studio has been on my list, but I haven't watched it and I haven't heard of The Editor.
Look, dude, it's really slow, but this director, Peter Strickland, is very skilled guy. He did this movie called The Duke of Burgundy I like a lot. And then The Editor is just kind of, it's been probably 8 years since I've seen the movie or something like that, but it's made by the people that did Psycho Gorman.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So, you know,
totally different, though.
Totally different. Yeah. But it's just got creativity in it, is the thing. And that's what I loved about Psycho Gorman as well. Being a shithead's fun. It's really fun. With you know, well-meaning shithead stuff is really fun still. So I'm gonna have to snag that Drop Dead Fred movie. I've never seen it, but I feel like I need to.
Yeah.
Get more Phoebe Cates on my shelf.
Yeah.
Dude, I love her.
She wears like these I don't know, like plainswoman kind of outfits with like high like Nike shoes or like Reebok shoes from the 90s, like all white, so cool. Like high socks.
That's awesome.
But there's a lot to kind of pick out of the little things that they do in that movie. So it's really smart. It's interesting that it's kind of like made for kids that were snuck into R-rated movies. The movie's not rated R, but the humor of a dude going underneath the mom's dress to be like, oh, you know, mega bitch, and she's got cobwebs up her
skirt. He says that?
Yeah.
Wow.
I thought he would do like I, you know, that noise that they would do, and it, like teeth chattering and like.
No, he's like that. He's super rude.
She's got cobwebs up her skirt.
Yeah.
That's so stupid.
Yep. But funny in the moment once you're like in sync with that tone.
And you're in the privacy of your own home. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, okay. It's like, you know, it's not like you're like, whatever.
I have three quick ones to drop before Watch Drive My Car. I was texting you guys about that.
Oh my God.
Don't even
get me started.
It's pretty not horrifying at all, but yeah, crazy story.
Well, I don't know. There's in that movie that are horrifying.
That's true.
Like walking in to your house unannounced and seeing something you don't want to see, and then just like immediately walking out. Spouse dying is pretty horrifying.
Such a cultural difference too. You never see that. Like, I don't know, unless it's the specific character, but I feel like, you know, that's a common response, you know, just, I want to keep this thing going, as opposed to US where you'd be like, you know, killing or having a huge argument or something like that there.
Right.
I also watched Titane finally, been on my list for a long time, and That was insane. I was like, I didn't know like what I was watching, because I didn't literally watch no trailers at all. I think I told you like the first 15 minutes I still didn't know what to expect in it, but it was cool. It was a cool, you know, messed up movie, and I thought about it a lot after it. So we definitely want to revisit it and see kind of what I missed or what themes are there, but just a crazy movie. I'm glad. Don't watch this if you're like a younger kid and you're worried about your parents walking in. It's pretty much,
oh my god,
graphic the entirety of the film.
Do you think that you're going to put any hydraulics on your car anytime soon?
No. Gosh, that ending though too, man. Just
or dance on a bus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The last one started Winning Time on HBO Max, the story about the Lakers dynasty, the series. I'm pretty sure if you've seen, you know, the Big Short or kind of Adam McKay stuff, you wouldn't want to be a subject of his documentaries. It's cool for us to watch and have fun with it, but pretty much any of the characters besides, at least so far, Magic Johnson, is you're seeing the worst of them, and you're seeing like a maybe true side to them that wouldn't necessarily be highlighted in documentaries. So it's interesting so far. I'm excited to check it out. I think Magic has his own documentary that he kind of supports also coming out this year, right?
Yeah, it's gonna be on Apple,
I think. Yeah, so be cool to kind of get two versions of this, maybe a more real one and then a more polished a Magic approved one.
Yeah, I'm sure they I don't really know the ins and outs of Magic's life, but I always like the idea, whether it's true or not, bringing humanity to somebody, kind of like what they did with Martin Luther King and Selma. They made him like, I mean, there's always been rumors of him cheating on his wife and things like that, but just kind of seeing that and just seeing like the grittiness of like, oh, they're humans. They're not the Batman or Carmen Falcone would say, oh, you thought your dad was a Boy Scout.
Yep.
So yeah, they're not the figures that we always may celebrate them as. And so it's interesting to see it and paint it in that light.
Well, you guys down to get into Fresh real quick and then go through Batman? I know we have a ton to talk about on Batman, so I don't want to miss anything there.
Sure. Yep.
Preston, so catch us up on Fresh. You kind of talked about it last time a little bit, and you got to see it early, right?
Yeah, I saw it at the Sundance Film Festival online, and just to kind of rehash a little bit of what I said last time, I very much, just like you described with Titan, I went into it blind, didn't know too much about it, just knew that I really liked the cast that was attached with Sebastian Stan and Daisy Edgar Jones. I was like, this is going to be like a romance movie with some sort of twist to it. And so, you can think about the title a little bit and you kind of connect the dots yourself. But it's a movie. If you have not seen it yet, please do watch it on Hulu. It's available on there right now. It's kind of like Cabin in the Woods, where you're walking on eggshells when you're talking about it. You got to be so careful, because there's just something about the shock to it where it leaves your jaw on the floor, and you want to completely experience that in the same way that you may have enjoyed movies like Raw or what was the name of that movie? The one from the 90s from Takashi Miike, Audition.
Oh, Audition.
So something like that, where you're just kind of eased into this very comfortable atmosphere, and then all of a sudden there's just a record scratch moment, and it just does not let up. So it's just it's a really fun movie, and even though it goes to some really dark places, it always remains human. I think the way that the director Mimi Cave, who comes from like doing music videos for artists like who'd she do? She did like I'm a dad, so like my brain is really bad.
Videos and stuff.
Yeah, you can IMDb her and see some kind of some of the bands that she's done, but the movie has really good music in it, and the way that she handles and navigates music throughout is really fun, like with Sebastian Stan dancing to 80s music, or having a more romantic moment dancing to Blood Orange music. And then the way that it impacts the editing later in the movie, where a moment that is happening in real time will be there will be parallel editing with something that's going to be happening just a few moments later. So the way that it just kind of plays with like this delirious state that you may be in if you were going through a situation like this, which is handled very, I mean, it's believable. It's a very extreme circumstance of what happens, but the details and the specificity in which it's handled is, or that's brought to it, feels so authentic. And so, yeah, it's a good time.
Yeah. I think when, you talked to us about it, you kind of did it well. It's obviously we can have a more fun conversation and maybe down the road, we'll drop a spoiler, quick review on it. But, the first 30 minutes of it is a romantic comedy. That's literally what it is. It's like Sebastian Stan playing like a Paul Rudd type in like a Judd Apatow movie or something, which I really liked for him. So I think we all know just hearing the title and seeing the poster, something, you know, bad happens. And I was texting, I think you guys, I was like, I almost wish nothing bad had happened on it. I could have just been down with the chemistry that they had. And I thought in the first 30 minutes, even though it's the non maybe thriller part, it was great just to kind of see things from a woman's point of view, like the struggles of what a woman goes through dating and just like getting, just saying hi to a guy on Tinder and just getting dick pics and just, you know, the asshole D-bag guy at the restaurant was amazing.
Oh my God, that was so great. Oh my God. It was like, he's like, you want to do this again? She's like, no. He's like, fine, you're a fucking bitch anyway.
And he has her split has her split it, take all of the to go for it. Like, just, yeah.
Dude, that shit is so funny.
In the scarf.
Yeah.
But that's what made it real. And I think the screen plan, it was great because she had a friend who's, text me when you're there, let me know what's going on. Who is he? That sounds creepy. That sounds sketchy. It's like all the total stuff that would happen now, where you don't trust anyone to be authentic. If they don't have social media, you think they're going to be hiding something or something's going to be happening. So
how we can do out, another.
Yeah. It was
we
cool.
Should just do another talk about this movie on a later date.
Yeah. Give some people some time to check it out.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. It's an amazing movie.
Yeah, twist definitely fun, and yeah, it's just really, really fresh. Ba-dum-tsh. Ba-dum-tsh. Yeah. All right, let's jump into Batman then.
Yes.
You Preston, Cole, you want to kick us off? Somebody?
Yeah, Preston, go ahead.
All right, I'll do it all. The Batman, directed by Matt Reeves, came out this weekend after many, many times that it's been pushed back. It started shooting in 2020, beginning of 2020, January 2020. And then obviously production came to a halt when the pandemic hit. And that brought up so many interesting questions that Cole and I have talked about off cam or off mic here about, like, man, I can't imagine being Robert Pattinson, being in that headspace of, especially after you see the movie and what he brings to it, and the arc of his character. It's a very troubled mind I bet he was in trying to, during that off period, because I think they were off for about 6 months before they began production again. And then it's finally here. And Batman's always been a very important part of my life. When I think back on my fondest memories of being a kid, I was Batman, I think like three times for Halloween. And I grew up with the Burton films and Michael Keaton being my Batman. And go into like Six Flags and they had like these little talent shows, stunt shows that they would do out there. I was just so enveloped in that as a young kid, as an only child for the first 13 years of my life. And then when my brother came in to the picture, he and I just really connected on that. I think The Dark Knight came out when he was about 5 years old or so. And then I just did the big brother thing of introducing him to stuff that he probably shouldn't be watching. And then as he got a little older, we got into the Arkham City games and Arkham Asylum, which were just so fun and has some really interesting connections to the particular tone that Matt Reeves creates here. And so I don't know, there's so much to discuss with when trying to set up this particular movie, but I think some of the big questions that we all have is how is Robert Pattinson? How are all these particular characters or particular actors and what they bring to the roles? Because that's always the most exciting thing, especially when they announce Heath Ledger as the Joker, and then you hear the discourse and everything, and then you see what he actually does, and it's just subverts your expectations. And so Cole, tell me about your relationship with Batman, and then what are your general thoughts on this film?
Well, Batman is my second cousin. No, I'm just kidding. That would just be whatever. That was dumb. No, I love Batman. Batman's my favorite, like hands down. I think that just comes from Mask of the Phantasm for me and the animated series. That's my big touch point for Batman, especially at a young age. The films I came to a little later, actually, minus Returns. Definitely came to Batman 89 later, just as I was growing up. But Returns, I was kind of in the pocket for it because it's got that snowy, Christmassy feel. I think kids really like that, which is kind of strange because it's a really fucked up movie. And it's a great movie, I would say as well. I definitely had Batman toys. I was telling Preston the other day, I break them all the time. It was just that kid. I just told you how much of a shithead I was and clearly still am. So I just would break stuff all the time. But I loved it. I thought it was really fun and effective, but also, I think at that age, there's something that I couldn't quite pinpoint why I liked it. I mean? And then as you get older, you're like, wow, the animated series is still great. Wow. Mark Hamill really is one of the best Jokers out there. You're like, wow, man, like there's a lot of Batman content out there. And then of course, the Nolan films, those are such a big deal. I was 18 when Begins came out and, much older when Rises and now this one is out. So I mean, I've really kind of been around since they started the Batman stuff, minus the Adam West stuff, which is ridiculous, but also entertaining in its own way. So I mean, the thing I think with Batman is you can kind of really have Batman your own way. I mean, there's a goofier side of Batman, there's a funnier side of Batman. There's really a lot to do within that universe, which you've seen from Harley Quinn, the depictions in Harley Quinn, which is still the universe. It's still the Batman Gotham era, Gotham area. The only thing that gives me pause is this is different from Nolan. It's not just, back then the big take was, oh my God, it's so dark. And it's really not. It's more of like, especially as the second movie goes, let's just talk about The Dark Knight. I'm not going to get into like the differences between all three of those movies, but like The Dark Knight is almost like a spy thriller with, kind of, I don't know, like not like a full on spy thriller, but it has a little bit of that 90s action kind of vibe that you would see, trying to get that guy, like take like a movie like In the Line of Fire, for example. John Malkovich is the Joker, in that movie. Clint Eastwood is Batman. He's trying to get him, Secret Service guy trying to get the killer who's going to assassinate the president. Harvey Dent is the president, that kind of thing going on. So, I think that there's a lot of really cool, like, potboiler stuff in that movie that really like plays well, but this really gets that pot boiling in a way that I think distinguishes itself. I'm still shocked that they went this hard with it in a lot of ways, and really committed to the form of the movie and really like making these scenes play out, really just making the film. You feel the length and you feel the dread, you feel the tension, you feel the psyche of all the characters, apart from one, which we'll talk about when we get into when we get into characters. But essentially with the film, you know, what I think is really brilliant with the modern age of superhero movies, and I think it has proven to be incredibly effective, is taking those movies and passing them through the filter of a different type of movie. You know, that's the way to do it. You know, and I think we really first saw that start truly where people talk about it in a mainstream widespread sense where everybody knew about it was Winter Soldier. And it's really continued through a lot of different filters. And that's great. And this is just another one of those filters done by a very accomplished director, Matt Reeves. People don't really talk about him, but he's fantastic. You know, I mean, he directed The Pallbearer in 1996 with David Schwimmer and has gone on to direct The Batman. So it's just, you know, it's wild. This guy, he, you know, we'll have to talk about him more, but this is the last thing I'll say. I mean, I think the movie's great. I think, I don't know, I don't want to be hyperbolic, but it's probably the best Batman. It's probably the best portrayal of Batman out there. It's incredible. I love it. Not without some complaints, but you know, what are you going to do? But the thing is with Matt Reeves, what I've thought about with him is he really just wants to kind of play ball however he can be used. You know, there's an interview with him I watched that I'll recommend. I mean, there's probably a ton of them, but I'll recommend. It's called The Big Picture. It's this guy, Sean Fennessy. He's on The Ringer. He's a very well-known podcaster. He interviewed Matt. And Matt just talked about, you know, like, yeah, I'll do another Batman. Yeah, I'll do other stuff that's not just franchise stuff. You know, that'll be on streaming most likely. I'm okay with that. That's great. I'm happy to do that. I think he just really wants to be like useful in his craft. And like, if he can do something, if he feels like he can do it, he's not going to have, you know, any trepidations about just like putting that together if the creative juice is there. So that's kind of my take on the movie. For the most part, my relationship with Batman and how that all kind of like leads up to this one in a way. And with that break, I think it kind of made that long Halloween more sweet, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
With the release of it. So,
yeah. Max, you said something that we were all pretty much thinking when we got out of this movie for the first time, was that because it's like so much of a detective story, it's going back to the origins of the actual character when it started out in like way back in the day, 40s, 50s, and of being like this, you know, the world's greatest detective, and it's a detective story. And you said that it didn't really need to be a Batman movie. It could have been a cowboy. It could have been a noir back in the day. It could have been just a simple detective story and it would function just great. But because it has Batman there, it makes it all that more exciting. Let me know what your initial thoughts were after seeing it, and then what your relationship with Batman was before going into it.
No, I think that was when I got out, that's the first thing I thought about. It's like, this literally doesn't have that sheen. There's no superpowers. It's Batman when he's younger, obviously, maybe a couple years into it, where he's not like an origin story. He's designed the suit. He has the Batcave, but he's not, you know, complete in what he has. He's still working on toys. He's still working on tools. He's not the portrayal that we typically see of the playboy billionaire, even though he's not that, you know, in all the Dark Knight series, he still has that portrayal. Here, he's the recluse. He never leaves. No one sees him. He doesn't talk to people. He doesn't even really help the world outside of trying to fight crime. But when I saw it, I really liked it right away. And it's just hard to describe because it's just so much going on. I felt like it was like an epic movie for the runtime. Mm-hmm. When it was maybe like an hour and a half in, I was like, oh man, the movie's about to end. And then I like look at my clock and I'm like, holy shit, there's an hour and a half left. This is awesome. Obviously runtimes we talk about, and it varies if it's a okay movie or a bad movie, or there's not enough substance there. 90 minutes is fine, but I really enjoy when movies like this pop up where I'm enthralled for the entire 3 hours and I don't feel like they cut anything out or missed anything. And then as far as relationship with Batman, I think it's just like most kids. I dressed up as Batman when I was four for Halloween, had the toys, obviously didn't, was watching the cartoons then and not any of the movies until I was a bit older. But as the movies came out, when I was old enough, I saw them all. I caught up on everything when I was maybe seven or eight to watch them all with my friends. So I don't have like a fanboy relationship to it necessarily, where it's like my favorite superhero or I've watched everything that's ever existed from it, but I've seen all of the theatrical films and I love the character. It's cool to have someone who doesn't have the superpowers and has this background, but to me the story in this is what really stands out, what they add to the world, how they treat characters, how they develop things, and you really have no idea where it's going throughout the film.
Yeah I guess why I've always connected with Batman is just because he's as it's been said so many times, like he's just this human being who is this vehicle for a lot of different things. Most of the time it tends to be very politically charged. There's something to take away from the way that, you know, the status of Thomas Wayne and like what he means to the city of Gotham and starting it up. And there's so much that we're going to get to with talking about the Gotham that we get here as it compares to others, because it really seems Gotham is in architecture isn't like Joel Schumacher, where there's like nude models like holding up buildings, and buildings are like thousands and thousands of feet tall, but it feels very real, and you can feel that this particular Gotham is a like a really nasty city, but always remains interesting. I think the biggest comparison that I took out of, or that I have out of seeing this movie is Blade Runner. It's always raining. It's always dark. And the way that in that movie itself, like especially with the theatrical cut of Blade Runner, where it opens with narration, because this movie does start with outside of the opening that we get with Riddler, we immediately get thrusted into the diaries of Batman, as he's kind of like, he's, you as you mentioned earlier, with him being like this very different Batman, he's a recluse. He carries so much pain, and he goes out in the night every night to just beat low key criminals to a pulp, just because it's like he's reliving the night of his parents' death over and over. And so here we don't exactly need to see those sorts of things that we've seen over and over with a Batman movie. We don't have to see, you know, Martha's pearls being spread out everywhere. We've seen it. We've seen it everywhere. And so it's just so interesting that, like, as you get into it, you feel like you immediately connect with the world because it feels so real, but also because you have, hopefully, I don't know how it plays for somebody who may not have that relationship with Batman, to where I think you would still have a pretty good grasp of it, because there's enough there to clue you in with, like, as we'll get into it a little bit later with, you know, there's a kid that's in this movie, and there's an instant connection that Batman has with him. And then you can draw your own conclusions as to like why he may connect with that kid based off of the death of his parents, and being an orphan and finding his dad murdered and mom murdered. Yeah, there's, I don't know. There's just like a shotgun blast of ideas or directions that we can go in with this, but it's just immediately right out of the gate, you're just so excited, and there's so much to think about and meditate. And I think that's what ultimately makes, because there's probably just like two big action scenes in this movie. There's like the car chase with Penguin, and then there's the grand finale. But it's very much a mood film, which I'll kick it back over to Blade Runner, which Blade Runner is very similar in that fashion. Although there's like not really any action scenes in the original Blade Runner. It's just entire outside of like a chase sequence, but still there's not a whole lot of movement to it. It's just, you're getting so wrapped up into the psychology of the characters, the world that's created based off of the cinematography and the music. It all just, all these film components coming together to serve this purpose of putting you into this exact space And very rarely does it ever let up to take you out of that world. So curious to know where you would like to go from here, but that's just kind of like, I love the film. I know I didn't really state that, but obviously I wouldn't have the fucking poster behind me and everything if I didn't give a shit about this, but I'm with Cole. I think this is the best version that we've had of this character. I mean, Cole recently watched The Long Halloween. There's two films that came out this year that hit at very similar ideas as this film. And like, as I touched on with the video game, there's ideas there that kind of carry across. So you can see like all the areas of inspiration that Matt Reeves plugged into to really just make this feel like a fully fleshed out world and all the characters that are within it.
Well, the thing is that makes it so, you know, as we start to talk about like tone and things like that, I think some of the things that really hurt other Batman movies, not really Burton stuff as much, but I think what comes in conflict with the tone is definitely the difference between Batman and Bruce Wayne. And here it really feels consistent in a way. It feels consistent, and the movie gives you a reason why it feels consistent, and that he, oh man, it's so, I'm going to wait till we actually talk about our character lineups and things like that to talk about, you know, actually the psychology of Batman and Bruce Wayne and how, and where they intersect, and like, if they intersect in any way, which they do, I think in this movie, they definitely do. And especially when we get to spoilers, that intersection is one of the best things I've ever seen in a superhero movie ever. A couple moments, but you know, that's the thing is like, you know, it's, I went so long just accepting what Christian Bale did as Batman. He's a great actor. I love Christian Bale, but just, you know, the playboy kind of like, oh, let's, you know, just get this yacht and have a bunch of Russian models on it. Like, that's not as, that's just so,
it's not as compelling, but it's funny and it makes sense with
it. It was funny, dude. That whole part is really funny because it does get him. It makes sense plot wise too, why he does that. But, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, in some moments when it really does work, you know, like when he crashes the Lamborghini, in the second one as well, stuff like that, you know, he's using that status and douchiness, you know, of that, but this really puts that line on there. There's just something I'm just like dying to talk about when it comes to Bruce Wayne and Batman. You know, tonally, and I love that. I think it's fine. I don't think there's any problems with it tonally. But I don't think people have been conditioned to accept this. And I think it's really fucking bold of them to release this. And it still feels like Warner Brothers is one of the last like bastions for making real cinema. And, you know, and if this is how we're having to get it through, I mean, I love Batman, so no complaints there. You know, get it through these superhero movies. I feel very happy that we're able to do it with this one, because, you know, even just so much as like, looking at like the boots Batman wears, they feel like they're rooted in the real world. Even his Batmobile feels like it's rooted in the real world. You know, and honestly, the Tumblr does too. I'm not going to lie. I mean, there's some ridiculous stuff about the Tumblr, but like, dude, I've seen some crazy, you know, US military vehicles, you know, but it really just feels rooted in a reality from something that is so small, like a boot on screen. You know, I think that's what makes a filmmaker be able to really get their tone across. There's something that and someone asked him about Claire Denis. Our audience probably doesn't really care about Claire Denis that much, but she's a French director. She's actually worked with Pattinson on High Life before in a really awesome movie, very weird movie. But Barry Jenkins said, he goes, Claire Denis is amazing because she can wrap up an entire like
civil war and military conflict in Africa down to a single coffee bean, which she literally does that in this movie called White Material, literally breaks it down into like a coffee bean. And this movie, you can break down the tone so much with something even so far as like a boot, a carpet tool, you know, little things like that, you know, something that can really, you know, you're literally like thinking about carpet, you're pulling the rug up from under things. You know, it's brilliant. It's fucking brilliant. So yeah, that for me tonally is where I was really, my gears were turning about those little bitty flashes of imagery that we see throughout the movie and the tactility of it, the rain on the lens, all that kind of stuff. It just, they covered the angles, and that's what makes this film so rich. And you bet your ass I'm going to see it again this week. Yeah. You bet. So
yeah, you said quite a few things there that we're probably going to get in more depth as we go along, but talking about the rain, I think one of the questions I put on our run sheet that I wanted to ask is like the moment when your guard came down a little bit and you fully accepted this as like, oh man, this is a Batman movie. Like I had my worries going in, but like now I'm just like along for the ride. I think the moment where that happened for me, that there's two specific moments. Like there's the one where we're first like how long and how they perfectly build up the reveal of Batman as he's doing the narration, and then we see him come out of the shadows, and the way that that's done is so, and then we saw it in the trailer. If you saw the trailer, like he just, when the guy, the one goon that's there, and he asks like, who are you supposed to be? And then he says, I'm Vengeance. And then he beats the shit out of him. And then he takes on like everybody there. That was the moment where I thought, oh my God, this is going to be fantastic. But I think the moment where it just like, I really settled into the mood that it was offering, and you made me think of it when you're talking about the rain, it's when he's doing that very voyeuristic thing where he's spying on Selena Kyle. And then you just hear the rain hitting the bill of his hat as he's like looking out, and the shot, the way that they shoot it, it's like, it's very close up on his eyebrows, and you see like his mascara running.
Oh yeah.
The owl eyes of him putting, which is very awesome that we're finally getting a Batman that just addresses how he needs to put his makeup around his
it's
eyes.
So cool. It's so cool.
In like, there's parts of like The Dark Knight that is awesome and as well shot as the action scenes are and the energy that Christopher Nolan brought to it. It still feels like, as you mentioned earlier, like it feels like it still belongs to like cinema in a way, or like Hollywood in a way, and not so much like I'm like a fly on the wall within this world, taking it completely in. Like in The Dark Knight, Christian Bale, when Joker comes into that party, and he's like taking the glass of wine and just like takes his, or champagne, he sips it and throws it and stuff like that. And then Batman's like behind the scenes, and there's this couple like getting frisky, and then he gets into the wall. He's like, oh, you got a safe room. And so within that, like you just can't imagine him just like addressing something as simple as putting on your eye makeup. Max, since you've heard more from us, what was that moment for you that you felt like this is a Batman movie?
Yeah, I like your question there, because I think that's what we all saw when you saw the trailer. I mean, the trailer looked great, cinematography was cool, but you're like, really? Like, can Batman be anyone other than gravelly voice, you know, the Christian Bale playing Batman? Like, I think we all thought that was like best level, best depiction. You know, obviously I heard this one was going to go darker and was interested in that, but he didn't seem like a fit for the role or a fit for the character for what we were going to get. So when I went in, I think, like you said, I was really hesitant as to, all right, what are we going to get? I heard good things about it, but you pick some good moments. I think when he's walking through the crime scene, when he's fully dressed up as Batman, and that's total, like you said, fly on the wall, real world, like he's walking around, he's not like waving his cape and appearing in the shadows and disappearing. He's like walking in through the back door, you know, checking like out the crime scene.
Ashamed to be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Like everyone's looking at me and this is weird, but I need to use my like you said, detective skills and technology to be there. So that was the point for me, but I just think it was cool to do movies like this, where I don't think this is going to be the Batman moving forward in the DC world. Like, I can't see him fighting crime with people outside of this really, you know, specific world with Catwoman. I mean, they have great chemistry. We can obviously talk about that in a little bit, but I can't see him interacting inside of the superhero world, because it just seems like
he's like with Peacemaker.
Yeah. Like, he just seems like a perfect fit for this, where I can totally see every other member of the Justice League, you know, doing what they've done and fitting in perfectly to that. So I think it's really cool what DC's doing. I love Joker. I think this is awesome. I don't know how it's all going to work. They definitely need to kind of find a way to keep the DCEU going, because they have, for once, momentum, I feel like, with what's coming out this year and what they've been doing. But it's just interesting how they're doing these one-offs. Like, we have someone else that's going to be playing a character that was just played in a movie that he's not continuing his role. So you're just having like almost just like different entries into cool stories, kind of like Preston was saying, where maybe their sweet spot is not trying to be a Marvel where you have 12 movies build up to one final 13th movie, but let's just play these characters and maybe obviously have them come together occasionally, but it doesn't need to be that. We can just get different versions of stories through different lenses. And to me, this is just a perfect example of like what you said, where I think the Joker kind of took on like a Scorsese role of the Joker, and saw this, we saw something totally different in a noir detective style for Batman. And although it's not what I was wanting when I originally went into it, I ended up, like you said, it became my favorite Batman movie, or maybe 1B behind The Dark Knight. So definitely did a great job of it. And I think for anyone going into it that has hesitation, because they're like we were, where, you know, how do you have a Batman that's this way? It just works in the world that Matt Reeves set up.
Yeah, rather than be like pieces on a chessboard that Marvel does, like where everything's strategically moved at this moment, it can be its own chessboard and just have its own fun and go in its own direction. Obviously we're teasing out we've covered Matt Reeves, we've touched a little bit on the cinematography, and I imagine we'll probably get a little more into that as we start talking about like the things that are done really well here. And we haven't quite hit on Michael Giacchino's score yet. So I'm going to take it back just a notch when we were talking about the moment where I fully accepted this film for what it was. And I think it was them using sandwiched in between the moment that I just described with him beating all those people, and then the moment that you described, Max, with him going into that crime scene, is them playing Nirvana's Something in the Way. And the way that the music kind of kicks up and he's on his bike, and you just see the way that the camera is just like really just putting you into this this headspace, pretty much what we were describing earlier with like Fresh, and the way that they cut things or shoot around certain things or blur the image, just kind of makes it feel like it's just a very narrow view. And then it shows like the wide shot of this like Times Square looking space or pocket.
I love that part.
And you could just like pause that moment and then just kind of look at some of the advertisements that they may have there. So I imagine this is going to be a movie that we study quite a bit, especially as we go more and more. We have more and more time with it, but the music. So Michael Giacchino did the score. That guy's been very busy. He's pretty much like the new John Williams of this era, I would boldly say, just because he's done a lot of and Cole has said said this to me before about like how much incredible range he has, where he can do a Pixar movie and just break your heart, and then he can do something like Spider-Man No Way Home just before, which that score just kind of serves the purpose. Its purpose in the movie, but here it's its own entity, it's its own thing, and you can listen to it on its own, and it has this journey on its own sonically without the images, but the way that they just kind of have this hand in glove relationship with everything else that's going on in the movie, it's just really something special.
I'm buying it right now on the Mondo one.
Yeah, the vinyl record.
It's a great score.
It's just so epic, man. It's not for every mood, right? I was listening to it in my car here when it was like 2 p.m. sunny. I was like driving to daycare and I was like, this feels totally wrong. But man, if you like throw that on at night, and I think we talked about this a little bit and we'll talk about it more, but it's like Batman is so moody, and what they have going on is just totally different and moody, but the score just it's steady and low when it needs to be. Yeah. And then at its highest point, it's absolutely like operatic and like epic and just the most ridiculously like crazy piece of music you've ever heard. And then it'll like drop back down to something else. I just love mm-hmm. how unique it is. Like, I'm curious to see with the vinyl, like, or how they have it set up. Is it going to be just bouncing back and forth, or is it going to be, you know, some moods set up, or how it's going to be? But it's just very unique, and each I guess track chronological. Is really different. Yeah,
proper chronological.
I mean, the thing is like, yeah, if you just put it on, like I was listening to it for a couple of hours. I don't know if some of the songs aren't available anymore or yet on Apple Music. But I listened to it for about 2 hours. And if you really listen to it, you can see the differences within the songs. But also just as a viewer, it's not obtrusive to the point where it distracts from the film. It only props it up as you're watching the film. Now, I went into my second viewing of the film knowing that I wanted to be cognizant of the score. And it's great, you know. The biggest ones, just I mean, the opening track, Can't Fight City Halloween, is great. Funeral and Far Between is great. Those are ones that I know have like stuck out for me.
How do you feel about the theme overall? As it compares to other themes that are out there.
I mean, the best one to me is still the Danny Batman Elfman. The Batman the Animated Series one. I don't know if Danny Elfman did that. I think he did.
He did.
Yeah, that's my favorite one. Hands down. Just dun, 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 dun. I mean, come on. It takes me back to going to Six Flags as a kid in the 90s, mm-hmm. you know, because I grew up, you know, you and I both grew up in the Dallas area doing stuff up there. So, I mean, it's like, you know, but I think it's great. I mean, I think it's really worth buying. I think it's a score to listen to. It's overwhelming. It's 2 hours long, the score. So, you know, I don't really think that sitting and listening to it all in one sitting is the best way to do it. So, you know, with it being a three vinyl set, you know, take it in chunks of 30 minutes, you know, and then digest those, restart it. But it's one of the best blockbuster scores I've heard in a long time. I'm trying to think which ones I've really liked. I'm looking at my blockbuster, my movies. Matrix Resurrections had some good one. Halloween had, you know, David Gordon Green's Halloween had a great score. Doctor Strange has a good score. You know, I'm trying to think of movies of this ilk that are great that aren't, you know, Pixar or something like that. So this is one of them. This is one of them.
Yeah. What do you think, Max?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't listened to the whole thing again. And I need to, because obviously I think when you have it separated, it helps a lot listening to it. Cause when you're into it, sometimes if it's doing the job correctly, you don't even realize or kind of pick up on it until maybe the scene slows down. But I think it's one of my favorites, and yeah, I'd be interested to kind of stack it up against some of the bigger blockbusters and scores that they have. But I think you're right. And it's not one you're going to, unless you're in a really, you know, funky mood, just throw all three vinyls with both sides of those on there for 2 hours, or listen to the whole thing for 2 hours one night, unless you got some, some stuff going on.
Well, it's all about the artwork too. You know, I mean, that's what part of the price point on this particular vinyl goes for. I mean, I'm not gonna sit there and jam, you know, certain things. Like I have the Interstellar score, for example. Yeah, actually that's one of my favorite scores, so I do jam that. But you know, I mean, there's just certain things. It's about the artwork, you know, and it's about connecting with it. And as you like, if you look at this on the Mondo thing, I mean, we were talking about it off mic, like it's, oh my god, it's just so sick. Like I just love it. Just see standing in front of these ciphers that are play a huge part of the first third of the film. And honestly, the dyes on the vinyl look cool, 'cause it kind of looks like, I mean, look, not to be like, fine, I'll just get super film intellectual about it. You know, if you really just want to like, you know, look at it, like if you look at these vinyl records, so listener, go look at Mondo. One of them is silver, like kind of gunmetal. One of them is blood. One of them is green money, Riddler, whatever you want to do. But the thing is, it kind of looks like an inky feel, like, you know, if you drop a, you know, some ink and some water and how it just like spreads slowly and it just like takes over like a virus. That's kind of like how crime does in Gotham. It just spreads and then just one, it just takes over, you know? And so I look at that and it just feels like it's all consuming, slowly brooding. And it almost looks like these colors are like a virus, like infecting the vinyl. I don't know. Maybe that's too much, but I think it really kind of, you know, made me feel that way. But I'm also the kind of person that just like stares at artwork for like 15 minutes. You know, I really looked at this pretty hard over the past few days, maybe since yesterday when it was announced.
Yep. I guess that's the benefits of being with somebody who is an art creator or.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. We talk about this stuff all the time. Yep. My girlfriend's an abstract painter, everybody, abstract artist. So. Anyway,
let's get to the character lineup because there's quite a bit of
characters. Please.
And so right at the top, as we've been like itching to talk about, yes, Robert Pattinson as Batman / Bruce Wayne here, and how those lines kind of blur for him. But Cole, why don't you kick us off with talking about that?
Yeah, dude, I would love to. Oh my God. I would love to absolutely talk about Robert Pattinson. So I've always been a fan of Robert Pattinson. I will say it. I really, you know, I'm probably going to roll through the Twilight movies for fun. I haven't watched them in about 10 years. So I like watching stuff that's whatever. So I think I'm going to watch through those. And I really liked him in the first movie. He's got some songs on the soundtrack. They're pretty good. I really like him. He's great. I mean, he's great. He's focused. I think there's something about him that, you know, if you watch his like Kimmel interview, watch him on Kimmel, you know, very mainstream spot. He's just kind of like, oh, shucks, and kind of like slinks down and kind of, you know, the only time I've really ever seen him be as much like himself, whatever that means, because I obviously don't know the guy, is like maybe in Tenet. He kind of has these like kind of slinky kind of movements that are kind of like, you know, just, you know, very like not really looking for the spotlight, but can't quite help but be a part of it in some way. And so, you know, I had some thoughts that I should have written down while I was watching the movie about him. But essentially what I'll say that I think is the most important is that intersection between Batman and Bruce Wayne that no other character was able to get. You know, I thought Michael Keaton was a fucking great Bruce Wayne. He does great in his scenes with Kim Basinger in the first one and Michelle Pfeiffer in the second one. And all that stuff. I think it's, you know, it's just really fantastic. But what he does that's, I think, the linchpin to this is he, you know, we're going to talk about the tech, but what Pattinson's able to do is, of course, okay, so the Kurt Cobain thing of it all, you know, that he's writing in the diaries. Cobain was known for his like diaries, you know, very disturbing stuff. If you go back and do research on that, like incredibly disturbing. And Batman, this version of Batman's pretty disturbing as well. There really feels like a keen difference between Bruce Wayne and Batman. It's not the same guy, you know, and we were able to see those differences compared and contrast quite a bit because he goes to the Iceberg Club, which is something that's been in all the Batman movies. They just take it to another layer in this one. And it's like called Club 44. It's the club with the club with inside the club, the actual club that they do. So he goes and visits this club as Batman and he visits this club as Bruce Wayne on different times. And the way that he moves about there and the way that he acts as he's walking through this club. But the thing is that really does it is there's this piece of tech that he uses in the movie. It's amazing. It's this thing that goes in your eye, of course. And like, he's able to see what the person is seeing, who
he can log his own with. He can log his own experiences as he does with after he goes to that first crime scene, And then they're contact lenses that pretty much have Wi-Fi capabilities in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. So this is the big thing that I've been winding up to this whole time when it comes to Robert Pattinson as Batman. What I think is the most brilliant fucking thing that they possibly did in the movie was the fact that he has to, and he's saying this in his narration, is he has to play back the night before because he fucking disassociates from being Batman. Dude, that is so sick to me. That is so, for one, incredibly sad. For two, smart, creatively. And three, you know, it really sets up that distinction between him and Bruce Wayne, that he even as Bruce Wayne, he's just hanging on by a thread, you know. And there's a funny moment in the movie. There's a lot of little snickers in the movie. There's a part where like Alfred's like, have some berries, and you see him pop a berry into his mouth and it cuts. Okay. So like, you know, you think about like emo boys living off of coffee and cigarettes. He looks like that kind of guy, you know, that's just living off of coffee and cigarettes. But it's like, okay, he's going to eat a berry. Sure. Okay, dad, you know, I'll eat the berry. It's so funny. But the disassociation thing that he does, that when he's beating that person's ass, that's not Bruce. That's something else that's taken over. And I think that's what happened with Pattinson in the act as an actor is like, you know, I talked about this with Preston and I talked about this with my partner, Erica, is that like not wanting to get out of that headspace and the work that comes with that and not wanting to be social. Whenever I was like being really stupid at the beginning of the podcast and I said, I've seen the film twice. That's like how he talks. He's just kind of like, yeah, like Preston was talking about this line. And if you've seen the movie, you know it, but like it's towards maybe 3/4 the way through the movie, maybe 80% through the movie, is when they find the Tucker. He just says, they killed Mitchell with it. Just like that. Yeah. It's not swear to me. Yeah. You know?
Where are the other drugs going?
Yeah, it's just like, come on. Yeah. I mean, that's fine, but it's
nervous ridiculous. About that in the trailer because they show that trailer when he's beaten on the
glass.
With the Riddler on the other side and he says like I could never tell what he was saying, but that's not the cut that's in the movie,
right?
He says like where are the other guns go? I couldn't understand it. And then when you see the movie you're like, oh, okay. So it's like he even like maybe that was one of the first shots of the movie or something like that, and they kind of figured out along the way, because I heard that Robert Pattinson had this very heightened version because he couldn't exactly ignore the fact that, well, what Christian Bale did with the voice is so iconic at this point because it makes sense. Me and Cole talked about this, like it can't be like the Superman thing with Clark putting on the glasses and then everybody just doesn't recognize that he's Superman. There has to be some sort of thing there, but because Bruce is so, his appearance in this movie is so minimal, like it's maybe he's in it like less than 10% as Bruce Wayne.
Right.
There's like very subtle differences in it. You can tell when he pops up to that iceberg lounge when the first time he goes up, he's Batman and he's like, do you know who I am? And then when he goes the second time as Bruce Wayne, he says it differently. And it's just like these very subtle adjustments on the decibel level that makes it fun, but also feels like it's still within that reach.
But the thing is,
lines blur.
But the thing is I don't feel like the actor, the thing is why people make fun of swear to me and the Batman voice of Christian Bale is because it didn't feel like it was a subconscious distinction. It felt like it was an acting choice. Yeah. With this and Pattinson, it feels like that Bruce Wayne is not making those choices to stand more squared like that whenever he answers in Batman. And also the way that they frame him, he's in the middle of all of these shots all the time. You know, sometimes he's over here to the side. You know, the guy says, excuse me, and Batman's over here. And then you just see him like kind of like turn a little bit for the guy, you know. But the thing is it felt like it was a very like subconscious decision on the part of Robert Pattinson as an actor and as the filmmaker that it just kind of happened naturally with the flow of the film. So I think those parts are the best like juxtapositions of that. I mean, the only real big scene we get with him is the funeral.
Yeah.
Which is God, so good. But yeah, you know, I mean, so I don't know, I guess we can,
which is still pretty much being Batman within that.
He has to be. So yeah.
Yeah.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead. What are you going to say?
No, with the way that he's observing things, he's still doing that. So it's like he's still feeling out who he needs to be as Batman. And that's what ultimately makes the journey in this, best Batman interpretation, pretty much what you were saying earlier, is the arc of his character, of where it goes and the lessons that, because most of the time when you see Batman, or as he's portrayed in these films, the arc of his character is not as interesting as it is here, where, I mean, he's just there to kind of be a cog in the wheel, like try to get everything, like move the pieces and make sure that they accomplish what they need to. But here, as I said in my written review, that this is a legit Batman movie, and The Dark Knight feels like it's, you know, a super villain movie that Batman just so happens to be a part of. But the arc of his character is just as interesting, if not more so, than a lot of the other key players that we have here.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is like, you know, you really, I don't think it's a big deal to talk about these like small moments, because a lot of the things that I love in these movies are like the small moments. Hence why, like, I love like Richard Linklater, you know what I mean? Is like, there's this moment where he's like looking around and he's standing there and he's getting his car to valet, and you don't really think about it, but he gets out of his car, he walks around it, he's standing there. It's the first time you really see any, it's the only time in the movie you see reporters like being interested in Bruce Wayne, because he's such a recluse in the movie. Nobody sees him, nobody really thinks about him, but they're like, oh shit, Bruce Wayne is here. And you're looking at his perspective as he's like looking around, as he's like doing that. And then you just hear the valet with one line, here's your car. And then you're like, oh, and you're snapped out of it. And you're like, oh wow, he's really observing. And it's like, it's an interesting or point to show the audience.
That Martinez police officer who's like, oh, Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
And then he just has no human response to it.
Yeah. And that guy that played Martinez was awesome. I loved the way they used him as a cop in the movie, because you're able to track the different interactions they have with Batman versus Bruce Wayne. You know, and he has like three or four interactions with Martinez throughout the film. One incredibly key one. But yeah, I mean, Max, I'm sorry. We've just talked and talked about
that. No, you're good. I was letting my dog out. She was like pawing at my door, making a bunch of noise. So no worries. Batman, man, it's just kind of some of the things you were talking about make me realize the story building of it, how much stuff they have going on that they don't need to. Like, typically Batman is like, here's a villain that I'm fighting with my hands and battling and dueling with the entire movie, where here he doesn't even ever get to, you know, have a close hand-to-hand combat really with the villain at all. It's just the detective story. But the same thing, like, they have such a cool story in the background of like a video game where you have the other mayoral candidate that's running. You see her billboards, you see her name, you see her on TV. She plays a really small part in the movie, but it's just all of these different things they have going on that are so interesting for the characters.
It's the coffee beans thing that
Cole's
talking about.
It ties you to it. It ties you to it, you know. Absolutely. Like, as we get to the end of the movie, there's a moment with Mayor Real that I was like, whoa. And yeah, you don't really get anything to it. And I didn't really think about the Blade Runner aspect, but with all those ads and that propaganda that you're seeing, dude, it's so Blade Runner. It's so Blade Runner.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get to some of the other players. So there's Lieutenant James Gordon, played by Jeffrey Wright, who is a very different Gordon. It's really cool to just kind of see their dynamic play out in the way that it does here, as it compares to somebody like Christian Bale and Gary Oldman, who also had a really nice dynamic, but the way that it's just like they really are partners in this, and the way that they work with each other to like Jeffrey Wright as James Gordon here, like he sticks out his neck and he's like putting his role on the line in some extreme ways that feel very realistic, where we see, you know, the journal that's in this movie and it says year two, and then he even has a line with Batman as they're going to investigate a scene where he says that, you know, 2 years of us being together and I still don't know who the hell you are. And so even that mystery of their relationship like compels him to the point where he feels like he trusts him more than he trusts the fellow police officers that are on the force, especially as things kind of play out. But what did you guys think of that pairing?
I like that actor, man. He's just everything he's in. I've never seen a performance from him where I'm like, oh, that was okay, or he didn't nail it. It's totally different than other ones too. Like you said, they don't even like make a big point that this is who this is. He's at that point still lieutenant, right? So he's not, you know, the future roles. There's multiple people ahead of him who are like telling him not to do things. So there's even more risk for him there, where he's sticking his neck out and he's not the highest ranking person. He's, you know, third or fourth on that list. So I think he's the only one we have on here from the police force, but that whole just police force / victim pool is just so cool. That range of people who look like they're shady to who look like they're upstanding citizens, to everything that they have going on with the underworld and all they've been doing, and the story that it sets up is just, it's really cool and unique. And I know we'll probably talk about it a little bit here, but the city is just so crazy, man. It's like a perfect mix of Chicago and New York, where they like take bridges from Chicago with like kind of the river area and some of the shots. I just have no idea how they build this, you know, totally fake town without huge identifiers. I know, like we talked about, you know, Madison Square Garden a little bit, and maybe some other key spots that they redo, but it's just such a cool blend of it.
I think it's all digital screens, man. It's all like digital created worlds. And then they just like move the camera around it, you know, not like they did in Lion King, but I don't know. I'm ready to see more of the special features, but I do know they use these like huge screens to like do all the, you know, the talking scenes, like especially like, you know, the biggest one is that one with Kinsey, Selena Kyle, Gordon, and Batman, you know. So
pretty much that's up there where the spotlight is. Those are they're called, the tech is called Volume, and they're just these virtual screens where they can create the backgrounds and they can keep that continuity there. Greg Frazier, who shot Mandalorian episodes, that's where he comes from. So he brought that experience and that technology to this, which ultimately kind of gives it, Cole and I've talked about this quite extensively, because that ends up being like one of the most interesting parts of the movie, especially from an artistic standpoint, especially when you get to like Carmine Falcone's room in the office that he has, and you see the background, you just see like cars going by in this tunnel, and there's a bit of a separation there where it doesn't feel like, if you were in that space, that's what it would naturally look like, but there's enough interest there that it feels grounded, but it also has this artistic appeal to it. But with those background moments of when they're at the bat signal, you can tell it doesn't feel like, I don't mean to like knock what Zack Snyder did for like Batman versus Superman, but you can tell the difference between like what's a green screen and what's not, and for how much they worked so hard in this movie to make it feel tangible and practical, down to the way that we were talking about earlier, with like cameras feeling like they're mounted on vehicles and on helmets, or when he's flying down through the city with his wingsuit and it feels like a GoPro that's attached to his head. The navigation of it, the way that it looks, it just really makes you feel that you're so much a part of this world. And with the screens and the bat signal scene with the light, the way that it reflects off their skin, it feels natural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really does. But, it does.
But I was going to make a joke earlier about when we were talking about the pairing between Gordon and Batman, because a thing that always bothered me about the Nolan films is the screenplay is not quite as sharp as it is here. We were talking about like how moments just kind of happen as they would in real life, and you just kind of pick up the pieces along the way. You don't need the complete A to B type of characterization, where if you watch like The Dark Knight, they say each other's names over and over. It always drove me nuts when they're like, Gordon. And it just like, it perfectly like sets up like as if they're reading the script versus something that unfolds as it would in real life. So that was something that stood out to me, that even though we didn't see that whole year of Jim and Batman together, it feels like you have.
Yeah, the history is rooted there pretty easily. And that's just a testament to the actors. I mean, Jeffrey Wright's great. So I love him. He always is a standout for any movie he's in. He's always making really good acting choices, even if they're large or different. But he was great. I'm very curious. Oh, God, I would love to talk to him about what he did to, you know, get to that headspace and what he... Yeah. There's just something unique that he did with the film. I'm not exactly sure yet, but it was great. Yeah.
Let's quickly try to run through, because there's a lot more that we need to cover, and I don't want for us to run out of time. So we got Selina Kyle, Catwoman, Zoe Kravitz. She's fantastic in this part. I think it's hard when you think about her, you think about, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer and what she brought to it, but there's stuff going on tonally with what Burton does with this kind of cartoony feel as to why she becomes Catwoman. But here it's, as we've been saying, and what's going to be the ongoing theme or the needle across this entire thing, is that everything's rooted in a reality that we know. So we don't exactly see her with her cat ears or anything like that. It's very subtle with like the mask.
Very subtle.
She wears.
Yeah. Her nails are literally like the style that celebrities use to make them look like cat nails, stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Leather suits and everything. And the way that she moves, and she does have a scene where she drinks milk out of the fridge, but
yeah,
it still feels like it's rooted in reality because she has a thing for strays. And that just says so much about her. But yeah, I thought she was fantastic. And I'm glad that they carried that relationship across to the entire film, especially where it ends up with both of them at the end of the film.
Yeah, but she disappears for a little bit. And I'm like, oh, man, I missed her on screen for a while, I think, too.
Yeah, like, they have but like when she comes back in, it makes total sense. And I love the way that they reintroduce her with this is something that Cole and I were talking about, that we just love that. How they all the devices and everything that's set up here character wise or the tech wise has a greater purpose within this, and it serves something to the story or to that character, rather than just being like, we're gonna check all these boxes, you know what to expect out of a Batman film, and we're gonna make sure that those are in there. And you know, with like what you would watch with like Daniel Craig's Bond movies, you're like, okay, yeah, you know, the car, all these certain lines that he'll say, and they got to do all those sorts of things. But with like the relationship that he has with Selina Kyle, with these contact lenses, and like how she serves, how she helps him in this trying to figure out this crime, is definitely one of the strongest aspects of the film.
Yeah, her stuff she's in the underground club is so funny, because it's hilarious. He's like, look at her, and you know, as a pretty girl, if she turns around, they're gonna be like, oh cool, I gotta talk to her now, she'd get a double take. And she's like, I really don't want to turn around.
That stuff, man,
is cracking me up.
I love
Peter Sarsgaard.
Yes.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I love the part even early with when we are introduced to Colin Farrell's Oswald Cobblepot, aka the Penguin, is when they're in his office, and he's just kind of like looking at both of them, trying to diffuse the tension a little bit, because there's like some sort of attraction that they have towards each other immediately. But yeah, love that.
So I want to kind of talk about, instead of like, I mean, Zoe Kravitz is great as Catwoman. She's awesome. There's tension there. I loved it when they kissed. The kiss was just so, made me feel so warm, and I just loved it. I thought it was great.
And their flirt fighting.
Their flirt fight was so good too. And he's like holding her, you know, it's like, and it was funny because like, he didn't really need to keep holding her in that moment, because I'm like, okay, like calm down. But they wanted that.
Yeah,
she wanted to feel held, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know.
Reminded me of Carol, like the way that they just kind of gaze at each other.
Yes,
like, yeah, like when he's like checking the contact lenses, you can feel that
I love it,
that romance.
Yeah, it's awesome. But oh man, their ending moment, oh my god. It's the last shot of the film, you know. I mean, you know, the thing is that I think is interesting is that dynamic between her and him in a way that intersects with the Penguin. You know, I'm just so curious, you know, how that whole world and that whole dynamic, like, if he had any idea who she is, if he just got lucky, you know, or it just, if she knew who he was, and if she just like needed to come into the room in that part, you know, that's kind of what I think is really interesting between them. And, you know, finding that throughout the film really makes their relationship, you know, work in a way that's beyond just like, oh, let's have them flirt just because, you know, it's kind of like that really stupid scene in Star Trek Into Darkness when Alice Eve is like in her underwear for like no reason.
Yeah.
You know, she's in her underwear in this movie too, but it's for a reason. Yeah. You know, so I'm just curious, you know, how she, you know, if she was being like a little more plotty to try to get into there to like be next to the Batman. But the thing is, you know, the biggest thing is with all of that is her motivations, you know, in putting a woman in danger, because that's what the film ultimately does. Not Catwoman, but her friend Annika. And like, that's why she is trying to find her. And the movie like takes that very seriously. It doesn't just use it as a plot point just to like strangle her. You know, it really is important. And, you know, her sacrifice is felt through the film. So, you know, through all of that and the connection between the Penguin, who is honestly like another linchpin to it, like he is essential to the movie, and not just like throwing in another villain like Venom in Spider-Man 3 or something like that, you know, just for the hell of it. It just feels that interconnectivity between all of those characters is really palpable. So that's kind of what I was trying to say.
Yeah. Let's talk about intersections.
Let's talk about the Riddler, quickly Falcone and Alfred, and move on here a little bit. I think obviously the Riddler, we haven't talked about at all, but he probably has the, you know, most unhinged, most over the top performance. And it's interesting. And it's kind of similar to some of these other movies we've seen recently where it's playing on, you know, toxic masculinity and kind of the you know, lone white male outsider kind of thing that we've seen in movies. And it's definitely interesting. And the character is cool in what he's doing. It definitely reminds you of the Dark Knight where Joker pops up doing any like the scariest stuff you've ever seen in any Batman movie. And they really kind of take that to the next level. I know, Preston, you talked about in your review Seven, and I know we talked about that and had some, you know, even some like Saw vibes or things like that to it, which is kind of crazy. And he had a cool performance, but I did also want to make sure we don't kind of jump over Alfred, because that scene in the hospital with Robert Pattinson was so damn good. He crushed that one. He wasn't in this a ton, but I feel like they always cast Alfred so well and give him just enough dialogue to make him like the most likable, grounded, cool character in whatever kind of screen time he does get.
Yeah, yeah.
He needed more.
Yeah, he did.
They needed a couple more scenes. I mean, that was my only complaint. My biggest complaint with the movie is they needed a couple more scenes with him. That scene in the hospital is fantastic. But they needed a couple more because the scenes were good. I loved like Alfred like doing the puzzle, and I loved, you know, checking the mail, but it just needed more. But he was great. He was really good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing that they were able to just have all these characters, and it to me did not feel like it was overstuffed or overcrowded. Like they popped up when they needed to. They did what they needed to do to move the plot forward and create a greater interest and immersion for what the story is. Even down to Alfred just having his few scenes, he feels like a real character with him walking with his cane and the possible service that he may have had in the past and being at war and the history that he has with the family. It can just be felt. And real quickly, Carmine Falcone, I think when, especially after I've seen it three times, I think he just John Turturro, just is like slowly becoming like one of my favorite performances out of the entire movie. Nice. Because his time is so extremely limited, but every moment, I think that's like one of the most fascinating performances that he's ever had in his career.
Yeah. Really,
because he's always been such like this very jokey and person, especially in the later half of his career. But with this, like kind of going back to like Barton Fink and that kind of tone and that feel was really fascinating. And Cole, I know you want to talk about his sunglasses.
Oh man, I loved his sunglasses. Oh, I'm definitely like, I wear glasses every day. But I'm definitely like a sunglasses inside kind of guy. Like, yeah. It's just, you know, I don't know. Some people just have like some weird, like not weird, but it's just protection with their eyes. You want to feel guarded, and it's a way to feel more safe and more comfortable, I think. And he uses it, I think, for power in the darkness, you know, but
he does really only have what, like three scenes, and all three of them are like key scenes to the whole film and what's happening. And I especially like the one where Bruce Wayne thinks, you know, Selina Kyle is with him and like goes up to him, and then the bodyguards kind of push him back, and he like explains a relationship, and they have this whole, like I said, I'm not super into the comics, but that his dad saved him on the table inside of their, you know, their house one time, and have this kind of rooted relationship, which plays out in the end that we can talk about in the spoilers
for
a little bit.
What I liked about his Carmine Falcone is like, he'll talk to you. He'll be cool with you. Yeah. I'll talk to you, man. But you know, dude, he will kill you. Like, he will absolutely kill you, and it will not be pretty.
Yeah.
You know, the Carmine Falcone in the Long Halloween movie is another great Carmine Falcone. I think Tom Wilkinson is really good as well. And I love that scene in Batman Begins with him. It's one of the best parts of the movie, I think. But this just has this like menace, and he's nice. And I think the movie like uses it well to the end because like of what the reveal is of his character and what happens to him. But we've never really seen and Falcone that is quite this in depth so quickly, and yeah. that's the thing.
Yeah,
you find out a lot of his history and things like that, and that's what I really like. But yeah, I loved his sunglasses. I mean, it was really smart character design, whoever decided that. Great wardrobe. Yeah. I love that shit. He really was one of my favorite aspects of the film because I did not know he was in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. We've talked a little bit about Gotham and the Bat Tech. We mentioned the Batmobile. The reveal of that is fantastic, and yes. As we were talking about the design of how it really feels like that Batman put this together and didn't have like Lucius that crap made it for him, like the way that it just feels like a Punisher type of vehicle, like he just really just put it together himself.
Don't you see a scene of him working on it too at one point? I think when they have all of those car pieces on the ground, and you can see what it is. It's like a muscle car that's like built up, but it also has like a, you know, like a jet turbine on the back of it there too for moments.
Yeah, and even that when because you know what the hell it is as soon as that great scene with the Penguin,
so good.
Where and I mentioned this to Cole that I really loved with the Penguin, the way that he's just so wild, and he just like puts the gun, the Uzi over his head, he's like, "Hey, you want to mess with me?" And but then it just immediately followed up with the rev of the engine, and then the engine just kind of has a false start, and then that gives them the so it just like, even though it has that, like, because so many moments throughout Batman history have felt like everything's so clean, you know, with like when somebody opens up a book, it's exactly where the page that it needs to be, that sort of thing. And then with here, it just feels like they're flipping through the pages, and it makes it feel like it's actually happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Bat, no, absolutely.
Too, I mean, right. Batcave was not polished. It's this like,
he went down the stairwell thing. With the motorcycle.
Oh, yeah. Something really cool that he said, that Matt Reeves said about that is the idea of that is that the, that is like an old, like back in the day, the history of the film, back in the day, the Waynes, they had their own train track that would go into their estate. And that's essentially what that is. It's the old Gothic train
that we didn't talk about that, but that was such a cool take on it. Because I think they still did they still have a house outside, or is they're in the tower the whole time?
It's like the tower.
Okay, because some of the scenes with the tower with the architecture were so cool, especially when he was getting blueberries with his butler there. Just kind of seeing how that works and how that looks instead of having it being the mansion kind of in the middle of nowhere. I think that was a cool take on it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about Gotham feeling like it has had its history. It doesn't feel like a modern type of thing with like which worked completely well for what Nolan did with like all the fluorescent lights that go down the tunnel, like there's a good mix of like old and new.
Yeah, I think that's catching really cool. Him younger too. It's not, you've seen Ra's al Ghul and did all this and have been fighting people and spent 10 years and billions of dollars building it all, but much bat tech in here though, and they like slowly show it all throughout the movie. That's not like he's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's like, all right, I'm going to use this, and then my chest plate comes off and becomes a, you know, a knife. Battery. And I have a secret compartment for adrenaline if I'm about to, you know, get annihilated.
My audience laughs so hard at that when he's like, ah,
at the end. That was crazy.
And then you're like wondering like half of the movie, like, why does he have those arrows right there? Like, what in the hell is he doing with that?
Yep.
And then you're like, oh damn, he is like straight up like piercing people with those things. Like,
yeah,
so awesome.
Yeah. Do you want to touch real quickly on any of your most favorite parts of the entire movie?
I mean, where to start?
No, that's really actually hard. I'm trying to think. I like the nightclub stuff. When they first had the nightclub scene, I was like, oh man, we're gonna do like a repeat where he goes in and beats everyone up, but it became a big piece to the movie, and I think that's because the ending obviously tied that into it. But everything in there was cool from him at the beginning, but I think the stuff especially was when he was pissed off trying to talk to the Penguin and just kind of doing the old school Batman beating everyone up until I can get what I want was a cool scene. But it's got to be more of the artsy stuff for me is my favorite thing, is just the little moments that they have. I think, like I said, the hospital scene was one of my favorites. All the stuff he has with Selena Kyle is really cool. And I think for me, the best scenes are the stuff with the great cinematography, where like they switch to a scene and you're like, oh my gosh, they just did that. Or is that the mirror of the motorcycle? Or, you know, the when the district attorney scene happens and he gets something put on him that looks like a police siren in the car, and they have the, you know, all these really cool moments. I can't even pick any. It's just the whole thing was cool to me.
I have two things that I'll say. I mean, my first favorite part of the entire movie is the fact that they were able to make the movie dark and let the audience still be able to see what's going on. You know, I just remember back watching the Han Solo movie in theaters and being like, I can't see shit, and being so agitated by that. It's not a good movie, but, you know, just being able to see in the darkness, like, that's, thank you, whoever like did the color grading, like, they just really knew what they were doing. They knew how to shoot that stuff. A part that I thought was amazing was after the Penguin chase, Penguin is flipped over in his car. And so you're seeing the Batman from Penguin's perspective. Mm-hmm. And he's upside down. And it's like he's like the man with no name, dude. Like, it's like he's like Clint Eastwood coming at you. Just like the way he's staring. And he even steps and you hear clink, clink.
His clink. Boots, man.
And with his boots. It's awesome. I think that might be the moment where I was like, whoa. I mean, there's so many great. Wait. My favorite is like the last thing that Batman does in the final battle. Like, I think that's the best moment of the entire movie. But as far as like fun stuff.
Is that
like
the hallway that scene?
Well, oh my God. Like,
the hallway scene, like, I forgot, was really cool.
With the machine gun. Yeah, that was amazing. No, the... I guess I didn't want to spoil it. I guess I can, but when he cuts himself down, that was just like, Batman is actually like changing. There's actually like character change here. You know, it felt natural.
It was all from the vengeance line coming back up again.
That's incredible.
That's what got it going. Yeah, that was mine. And I was going to say the Penguin scene. I think there's nothing that escapes, like nothing that quite compares to the thrill that you just feel your heart going. And the music just really kicks in, and then he's taken off, and then you see Catwoman snatching the money. And the way that that's shot, Matt Reeves said that they storyboarded this movie by doing it using like a VR technology. Everything that they did was they created all the exact spaces, and you know, he knew the geography of everything and where everything was going to shot, and they just took pictures for all the different angles, so that continuity stays there. So yeah, really remarkable.
That's cool.
Social commentary and criticisms. We could spend a great deal talking about social commentary. I know Cole and I were both irked by some of the critic that we really love and appreciate, who said that there's not a lot of social commentary here, but there's just so much, as yes. we've heard and said and hinted at. We could spend a lot of time getting into some really deep spoilers, talking about sins of the father and things like that, and how it plays out, and just like our thirst for blood and what it's saying politically. I don't know. There's so much to dip into here.
There really is.
Well, yeah. I mean, it definitely mirrors the world, and we get most of it with the Real character versus Mitchell, yeah. the mayor who was killed, duct taped to Mitchell or whatever the name of the score is. It's called like whatever. There's a piece of music in the score. It's called, I saw that. Mayoral ducting.
Yeah.
Mayoral ducting. Yeah, that's like what it's that. Called. It's I was like, yeah, it's perfect, and that's fucked up too.
By the way, we talk about, I had to double check and see if this movie was R or PG-13 after it. Obviously, there's no nudity or huge like cuss
Happy
words.
Fucking
but,
Halloween.
Yeah. But this definitely pushes PG-13 to the
it
limit
really does.
This dark.
Yeah, it does. You know, I mean, I guess we can just spoil the movie. I guess we can just make it like a
spoiler alert. Spoil.
This isn't really like a review of the film. We're just kind of like talking about it as a whole, as like in like, you know, generalities, but I guess it is. But I mean, so essentially what happens at the end is Batman, like, he cuts himself down, and I thought that he was like into like, because, you know, the end of the movie is a big flood, the whole garden is flooded. I live in a flood zone, well, not my house, but Houston floods, and it's flooding is terrifying, let me tell you. And you know, he cuts himself down there, and he does something that I can't really remember Batman doing with anything other than the TV show, is he actually helps somebody. Like, he actually like makes a conscious effort to like stop what he's doing and like help somebody and like put forth a lot of effort. And just the way that that film plays out and how that scene plays out, it's just so operatic and beautiful. How he, you know,
he's
kind of does
so normal in it though, right? Like when he's just grabbing it, it's not like he's like, you know, shouldering it and slamming it out of the way. Right. It's like he's doing what anyone could do if they were out there.
Over.
Yeah,
he pulls it over. He lights his fuse. It's funny because he does this weird face where he like does this. He's like, it looks like he's like sneezing, but he's like, and I guess he's like, you know, like ripping, you know, like you got to put like an oomph into it. It's a big electrical cable that he's cutting, but, you know, he guts down there and he just like moves over the debris to where, you know, everyone was standing. And, you know, I mean, I don't have a kid. I don't have a son. You know, I know you guys have sons, but he just gets that kid who just lost his dad, you know, and saves him. It's just really sweet.
Saved him twice.
Saved him twice. You know, I just, it's just really beautiful and really sweet. And then, you know, he saves Real and all those people. And then that over the head shot that's on my Instagram right now. I mean, you know, Preston was talking about it having like biblical ramifications. Yep.
Moses.
Dude. Yeah, it is. It's like, let my people go, dude. It's straight up like Ten Commandments type stuff. Yeah. Like it's incredible. It's beautiful. And it actually, it just shows the character growth, in a way that you've never seen with Batman. I don't care about the ending of The Dark Knight Rises. That still feels phony as fuck to me. I think it's kind of lame, whatever, but like
his voiceover though, when it's on the top of the stadium, is such a cool, like kind of wrap up to it. And just
It's the moment where he's when you're talking about that growth, or like when he like just has this moment of realization where it's like, I don't need to lean into fear. I can lean into hope. I can inspire people instead of, you know, fearing people into submission.
And that's not social commentary. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Unbelievable. And you know, the mystery aspects of the film are really good too. I had a blast solving the puzzles with them. Like, I loved that stuff. Thumb drive, El Rata Alata, you know, you are El Rata Alata.
Yeah.
You are
pigeon.
Wait, but what about thumb drive though? That one,
that was the shit. He's like, what are you looking for?
Hilarious.
What are you looking for? Yeah. That's what Gordon says. Yeah. It's, dude, okay. There's so many really great lines like that, that people, you know, really liked. And it's funny because I live in Houston, you know, I mean, our Latin community is huge here. And, you know, there are people that, like, once they figure it out that it's like La, or it's El Rata or La yep. Rata, not El Rata.
Yeah,
you know, it's like they're like, oh my god, duh, like that's so funny, you know, you're not thinking it, but like when he figures out URL, I'm like, and he like, he's like, oh, and he like types, I don't know how the fuck he does that, but whatever.
No, but you're right, because Preston talked about like not just getting that right away, like he did that a couple times where he's smart and knows things, but right. Yeah, working through it and watching him work through it too.
Yeah, it feels real too, just because it's like that moment with the L and law thing, like we could be like, we know the difference between them based on our geographic location or where we grew up. But it's great there because it's able to deliver that great joke with Penguin. And then I don't know, there's moments all throughout, like, because as I mentioned at the top with like this being quote, the world's greatest detective, they're kind of put in their place a little bit where they don't use their best brains here to try to figure out. And that's what gives it its human element or human aspect of like you know, Riddler being able to like, oh, you're not as smart as I thought you were.
Yeah.
And then Penguin calling him out on that, because my wife made this hilarious joke after I saw it with her, was like, you're telling me that nobody thought to like Jim Gordon to say, hey guys, talking to his other police officers that he works with, hey, can you guys inspect the angles of these photos
yep.
that Riddler gave us? And that would just key them right back to where Riddler's been located the entire time. So there's just like all these little kind of fun little things that are just like the more obvious clues, and then the not so obvious clues that are put in there that are really fun.
Should we talk about, oh good.
No. Go ahead. I was just going to say how great Paul Dano is, and yes. how great he is, and the way he uses his voice. He's brilliant.
Yeah. Screams. Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, so I know we talked about like seeing this forward and what world it lives in. I think the thing we can talk about first is there's two spinoff TV series, one on Oswald Cobblepot the Penguin, which is cool because I feel like they gave him just enough in the movie to make us want more, and it's not showing him as this huge villain, but he does have a spot where, you know, he can kind of take over
the kingpin now,
and so that's unique. And then also they're having the what first was announced as a James Gordon kind of Gotham PD spinoff that now they're saying is going to be more of a Arkham Dark Nightmare spinoff, and both those are really cool. And obviously with the success of Peacemaker, you can't assume that for everything. Oh, man. But I love the idea of characters in movies that don't have enough screen time, or that you purposely leave them more story to flesh out in other kind of mediums. Just such a cool idea, and I'm all about it. It's not necessarily like Marvel where you have to watch every single thing to know what's going on, but hey, I like this guy, I wonder what's their world's like, and boom, here you go. You don't have to wait
so
long for it.
So they're gonna have Colin Farrell in like an 8-episode Penguin series.
Yep,
probably like 6 or 8.
Yeah, on HBO Max.
Dude, they must pay him a ton to put that makeup on every single day.
Oh yeah,
they got it down to 2 hours though now.
Oh really?
Yeah, he said when they started out it was 4, but now they got it down to 2.
I mean,
he's unrecognizable.
He's great. I don't think anybody else could have done that. I mean, I guess you could have cast like Oliver Platt or something, but I mean, like, you know, it just wouldn't work.
Or the guy who voices Bing Bong.
Or the guy. Oh, yeah. But he, yeah, I mean, yeah, they give him that great last shot where he's just like looking over the city.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, yeah, contemplating it, like what he's going to do.
They're narrating like martial laws into effect. I'm like, oh, my God, like crime's going rampant because the city's flooded. I was like,
dude, yeah. I know. I want to know like what the angle is going to be there, you know, like because I want to know. It's like the ending of I guess it's The Dark Knight when he's getting chased at the very end. You're like, ah, you're like, damn, that's so fascinating. And then, you know. Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, it's probably
I'm excited for the shows.
probably going to be him taking over in the flooded, you know, stricken area, or hey, maybe we'll get some backstory on it. But yeah, whatever they do, I think it'll be cool to kind of
Ozzy.
Inhabit that same world. And I think, like we talked about, he's probably executive producing on it. So at least can, you know, keep it consistent in the vision at the beginning before they kind of run off with it.
Yeah. That's my greatest fear. Like, I think it's awesome that there's the possibility of exploring that world further, 'cause it's so fascinating. But at the same time, I'm like so protective of it now, because I feel like I've taken ownership of this movie a little bit, as an audience member, as we all have, when something's put out there, that I feel like it's like, I'm so protective of it because it's so fascinating. I almost want it to stay in that film format. I trust the storytellers that are involved, and if they carry that vision across with and it remains compelling and doesn't give me all the answers, I think we'll be in good hands. And as far as like my hopes for the future of Batman, we get that stinger with Joker. We can pretty much assume that it's Joker, Barry Keoghan playing Joker here.
Yeah, which is a cool casting.
There's just enough tease there to where like what his makeup would be. And I listened to an interview with Matt Reeves, and he talked about how that this particular Joker, you know, we've seen iterations where like he falls into the chemical, or he gives him self-inflicted scars, but we don't know the actual origins of that particular story. This one, it seems like it's going to be more of a birth defect, and just something that he's kind of had with him the entire time. So that pain of something that you've had your entire life is going to coincide so brilliantly with the pain that Batman has had in this particular story. Well, so
he says he has scars.
Yeah. So
he literally says it. So yeah. He literally says it. And that, you know, and I will, you know, I've kind of, I really want to watch Nolan's trilogy very soon. But the thing is that it's that I think that he did best with that is something that everybody remembers is Joker saying all those different stories. And I think because there's not a real answer for it, and that's just so memorable in the film, mm-hmm. You know, kind of like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction or whatever, you don't really know. But the thing is like that primed audience members, I think, to accept a bunch of different stories about Joker, you know, about this, about that. And it's just a different take each time. And I think that that's very cool. These are our fairy tales that we're passing down, you know, I mean, that's just what it is. The Joker is a big fairy tale character. Same with Batman, you know, and there's a lot of chances for these reinterpretations, even within consecutive years. I mean, I personally, doesn't really bother me. It's a different medium. It's a different type of story. It's a different type of voice. And if you can distinguish that, then that's fine. And they're absolutely going to, because Barry Keoghan definitely has had that little shit kind of energy, kind of like, hey, I put a bunch of pink dye in the washing machine kind of, you know, vibe, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I don't know if they're, because he said, Matt Reeves said that he doesn't know if that's going to be the actual focus in the next film, but they're at least setting up possibilities and making that world feel much larger than it is. But as far as that Arkham show, I really hope they do something like the Arkham Asylum video game, where they just make it feel like a haunted house movie. So there's just so many things that they could do with it. So I'm hopeful for the future, and I really do hope they make more movies.
Yeah, it looks like they said I was reading about it when you guys were talking, that they canceled the Gotham PD one, but I'm mad about it because it was supposed to be Batman's first year and him getting to know Gordon, and I'm like, man, that would have been really cool. So that's a bummer.
Yeah, but at the same time, we don't need it.
Yeah, that, it's that probably like they probably couldn't get Pattinson to do a movie.
Right, either, Pattinson's like not going to do that.
A TV He's series. So that's probably why. But yeah, you're right. The haunted house, and then the other story there with Penguin, and
like
I think
a prison takeover.
Didn't they already confirm Batman 2 or no?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
But not official, but it's going to happen.
Well, yeah.
The movie made a ton of money. Let me see if there's any news that broke today. I mean, no.
No. Yeah. Well, be curious to see if there is and how they kind of decide to deal with other, you know, other Batmans and other movies and other storylines and multiverses. Like, I feel like just the comic book world is just going so crazy right now with the movies that you can't really know, you know, can't really rule anything out. There can be multiple actors and iterations and do like a Spider-Man No Way Home with, you know, multiple Jokers and universes. It's not unfathomable, especially with
they can do that with the Flash since since you got Keaton coming back for that. And so I feel like that opens it up. And but I really doubt that I feel like Matt Reeves is going to hold his ground just as much as Christopher Nolan, be like, I'm not fucking putting Christian Bale in a Batman multiverse thing. And Robert Pattinson's not going to, I don't want to associate what we do with that world whatsoever.
But what's weird about DC is like they had, it's basically what I was going to say, but yeah, I think they had that kind of, like you said, came up where they wanted to keep it separate, but it's just like, how do you have so many different separate things going on where, you know, like Henry Cavill said he doesn't want to play Superman and then does, and Ben Affleck says he's done after this and then does one more, and who's going to be Batman and Superman now? Like, what's going on?
So Michael Keaton's playing Bruce Wayne, right? Again, he's playing Batman again.
Well, yeah, he's going to wear the suit again.
Yeah.
Batman in the Flash.
Just so weird to me. It sounds better than Black Adam with The Rock, but it's just so funny, man. Like I'm like looking at this news article. It says the Penguin series with Colin Farrell given a straight to series order at HBO Max, and then the subtitle is, sounds like Colin Farrell is in for several long days in the makeup chair. And then the thumbnail photo is the Penguin looking out upon Gotham at the very end of the movie. So it's all those three things that we just said. That's just so funny. Anyway, so I'm excited. I guess we'll probably get that next year.
Hope so.
Yeah, me too. Well, wow, that was fun talking about that movie for that long. I feel like we've all been holding off on our text conversation somewhat to be able to have some fresh ideas and interactions about that. So that was definitely fun. And I can't wait to, I don't know what the big next movie is. That's going to be an important one or big event. I can't really even think of anything.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still wrapped up in this movie. I haven't even given any serious thought. We'll let you know later.
Yeah, absolutely. Be on the lookout for another unnamed episode. And thanks for checking us out.
Yep.